Hello everyone and welcome to the latest episode of the If I Had One Wish podcast recording. I'm Crystal Hicks and I'm joined by a new co-host today, Hannah Locke. Hi Hannah, nice to have you with us.
Hi Crystal, thanks so much for having me this morning. I'm Hannah. I have been a board member with Wish Midlands since June 2022 and I'm a project manager at Platform Housing Group.
So our guest today is the one and only Lara Oyodele. So Lara is well known in the social housing sector. She's been a champion for diversity and representation for a number of years. She's currently the CEO of Black on Board, and we're really excited to hear from you, Lara, about your endeavours in that role on today's podcast, as well as all sorts of other things I'm sure we'll get into. So many know Lara as one of the past presidents of the Chartered Institute of Housing, where her In My Shoes campaign sought to raise awareness of the importance of racial diversity in the housing sector, I suppose drawing on Lara's own lived experience. The campaign has been described as a catalyst for positive change. So I'm sure we'll dig into what that was all about today. Lara is also chair of Hope Housing and in Bradford and a senior associate of Olmec. So we are delighted to have you today, Lara. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. So I live in Bradford. I have no pets, no children, no car. All the things that are very expensive, I have none of. And I guess hobby, it's ridiculous. What I do for fun is related to one of the things you've described about me is trying to make social change. So one of the I do it for fun because otherwise I'll be watching EastEnders. I watch EastEnders. I love to travel. And when I'm not doing either of those things, which is usually on a Saturday or Sunday, I'm running my many mentoring groups online. You know, so I'm working with young black girls and people want to get into the boardrooms. And I do it for fun. So I know it's a bit sad, but that's what I do for fun.
Thank you, Lara. It's so lovely to hear.
Great. Yeah. So, Lara, as part of these conversations that we're having for the podcast, we're really excited to be able to hear from female leaders and change makers about their experiences. And you talked about social change already as part of something you're really passionate about. And we'd love to give our listeners the opportunity to just appreciate what your journeys looked like, what challenges you've overcome, and just be part of that shared learning. And with that in mind, we'd love to ask you about your career journey. What brought you into social housing and what is it that's made you stay?
Wow, okay, so what's brought me here and why am I still here? So many, many, many years ago, I know I don't look it, but I'm very old. In the 80s, late 80s, I was a teenager and I found myself homeless because I got evicted by my landlord. It was a very naughty man. And everything I had in the world literally filled into a shopping trolley. I didn't have very much. I was a teenager. I just left home. So I found myself street homeless. I slept rough for a few months. I sofa surfed until I ran out of friends' sofas to surf and then slept rough. But what I was doing every single day was going to what was then called the HPU. I don't know what they're called now, the Homeless Persons Unit. And I used to go in every day and sign the form or, you know, just present myself. I need a flat. I need a flat. And I'd go in every single day. Now, the irony of this story is that at that time, I had a small admin job in a housing office. I was a yop. I don't know if you guys are old enough to remember yops. Yeah, so I was a yop and I had this position in a housing office. But I didn't know then what I know now, that this was a housing office and they might have been able to help me get accommodation. And also because I was embarrassed about being homeless. So I was working a few hours a day. I think it was 12 to 4. I used to go and work in this office and I would do type rent letters on a typewriter with the carbon sheet at the back. and make offers by going through the card index box and type out the offer letter and order repairs. So it was like really olden day stuff. And I used to do this for 3 hours after I'd gone to the HPU. It's only now that I look back and look at the irony, because I didn't tell anybody at work that I was homeless, but I was homeless and I was rough sleeping. And eventually I got a council flat with the very same council with which I was working in the office. But no one had connected the dots. I mean, when you're homeless, there's a certain embarrassment about it. So you don't actually want people to know. But anyway, so I kept it secret. And one of my biggest challenges at that time was how to keep myself looking and smelling clean. So you get to know where the free showers are and the free spaces that you can go to get clean and eat. But you don't want to stay in a hostel, because hostels are predominantly full of men who have maybe had too much to drink or had mental health issues. And I had neither. I don't drink, had no issues. So a hostel was the last place I wanted to go. But anyway, so that was the situation I was in at the time. And eventually I got a council flat. And I was so pleased to get this two-bedroom flat, and I got the keys, and I painted it blue because that was my favourite colour at the time. And my blue's back. It used to be red, then it's blue. But anyway, so I painted this flat, and I lived in this flat, and I loved it. And then that enabled me to go back to finish my A-level, because I was A-level age at this time. But obviously, when you're homeless, you can't study. There's nowhere to study. Okay, so I was able to go back, do my A-levels, then went to uni. And then I decided I was going to be a journalist. I was going to be KAD, studied journalism for 3 years, and then decided, actually, I don't want to do that anymore. I want a job that makes a difference. And I thought, you know what, that housing job I did, and that experience that I had getting a flat a few years ago, excuse me, I want to be that person that helps other people that are in that situation to have a home and have a flat and have a house and get off the street. So I then said, that's it. I want a career in social housing. So I applied to the LSE, the London School of Economics. And at that time, there was a grant, the government body called the ESRC, Economic and Social Research Council, were giving out grants for people to study housing master's degrees. So I applied, I got to the LSE. And the rest, as they say, is history. And that's how I started my career in housing. And the reason I've stayed, despite the many ups and downs of my career, is because I always remember that experience of getting my keys and moving into a warm place that had a front door and it was mine, and I had to decide which of the two bedrooms to live in. You know, I remember that experience, and I always want to. I want to spend the rest of my life being in a position to help other people have that experience. So that's my story.
Wow. Yeah. I've heard you share your story a few times, yeah, Laura, in different ways, and there's always sort of little new things that I pick, yeah, up from it every time that you share it with us. And I think I work in homelessness, and one thing that always shocks people when they ask me about homelessness is the fact that so many people are homeless and in work.
Yeah.
You know, there's a stereotype, isn't there, around, you just want benefits, or, you know, nobody wants to help themselves. But actually, so many people experiencing homelessness are getting up every day and still going to a job and, maybe sleeping in a car. I think the more we can do to sort of put a spotlight on what homelessness actually looks like, the better. So thank you for being so generous and sharing with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
So I want to talk about intersectionality, Laura. I couldn't have you on the podcast and not talk about this topic. So obviously you're an experienced leader, an experienced female leader in the sector. And women in social housing, one of the things we often get challenged about is, do we actually need a women's organisation? And by having that focus on women, are we being too narrow and binary in sort of the agendas and the things that we're sort of pushing on, and it drives me mad because it's like, come on, man, like, people aren't just women. People are women with faith, people are women who are disabled, people are women, you know, you kind of just describe people in that way, don't you? But yeah, I think it would be really great to just dig into you with you around this topic of intersectionality and understand sort of, especially as a Black woman, you know, what's your take on, sort of the exclusion and discrimination in the sector and people's awareness of intersectionality, I suppose.
Yeah. No, that's a very important topic and forever timely. It will forever be timely topic, I think. We clearly live in a man's world. So, I know, what's that name? That singer who sang the word? Mr. Brown. James Brown.
James Brown.
James Brown. It is a man's world. I mean, if you look at any photographs of leaders of the world, you know, any of those international conferences, there's like 25 men and maybe 2 women in the group, you know, and then you go down to, let's go to any collection of CEOs of housing associations, you will find that there's 70-80% men and, you know, a smattering of females. So we definitely live in a patriarchal world. And I say world because it's no different in the Southern Hemisphere. Any country in the world, you know, men tend to be the leaders, women tend to be their partners, and then you get one female leader and everybody starts getting all excited. You know, and I think that's unfortunate. It shouldn't be, because, you know, evidence shows that we are not any less intelligent than men. We are not any less clever. We're not any, in some cases, we're not any less stronger than men. So I don't know what the solution to that is, but it's an issue. So the patriarchy exists. And one of the things I like about women in housing, women in social housing, it's actually a brave entity to be there to say, yeah, we are fighting for the women in the sector. And the reason that I like that is because at the entry level, there are lots of women. In the middle level, there are lots of women. But as you get to the top, we become less and less. And you talk about intersectionality, I can replicate that sentence and just put Black people in there, and it's exactly the same. I can replicate that sentence and put Asian people in there, and the rest is the same. What I don't know about is if I mention disability or LGBTQ, I don't know if I can say there's many of us at the front line, in the middle part of the organisation, and is that reflected in the boardroom? So I can't answer the question for those two, but I know in terms of ethnicity and gender, we dominate the sort of junior levels of the organisations, the middle levels, the kind where we have to be kind and caring, we are there. But as soon as it gets to the exec team, as soon as it gets to the senior leadership team or the boardroom, we tend to be in a minority. And I like the fact that Women in Social Housing is fighting the corner for women. That's the good thing. Where I, as a black woman, feel about the universe is, I think all the hard work that has been done in business in terms of diversifying leadership teams and diversifying the boardroom, I find that white women have benefited more than any other minority group. So there are a lot more white, I'm not saying there's enough white women, but there are a lot more white women who have managed to break through into boardrooms than they are black people generally. Black men, I think black men they're like gold dust, they're scarce. So you've got a lot more Asian people, than black men. But white women have benefited the most. That's not a dig, it's just an observation. And I think that we need to work together more to not be afraid to say, we are only talking about women's needs. We need to be more confident in our ability to apply for senior roles. We need to be more confident in our expertise, our experience. We don't have to tick all 100% of the requirement in a job application to apply for it. I know my male colleagues will go, oh, I fancy a bit of that. I'll have a go. And maybe only 40% 40% qualified, but they'll have a go, and we'll still be beating ourselves up because we've not got 98% of the requirements. So I think that that's the space that Women in Social Housing provides. So I applaud its existence, binary or not. The fact is, we do not get the same bite of the apple as men do. We're always having to justify our existence. If you have a male child, your son does not have any problems with male role models in literally anything. There's literally no space. Even the so-called feminine spaces like cooking, men still dominate the leadership positions. Even the spaces like teaching that are predominantly female, men still dominate the leadership positions. So young boys do not have problems with role models. In terms of profession, young black boys have, that's a different issue. Young girls are constantly looking for role models outside of the traditional female spaces. But then I said, even in the traditional female spaces, the bosses tend to be men.
The bosses are men, yeah. Your point there around, you know, the women that we are getting into senior leadership positions tending to be white. I'm going to also say maybe middle class. In with that. And this is something at which, you know, we really challenge ourselves on all the time, you know, when we're saying, what does success actually look like here in terms of what we're doing? Just becoming like a talking shop for white, potentially middle-class women is not what we're all about. You know, we're constantly thinking, how can we diversify our regional boards? How can we put on events that will work for younger women, work for single mums, work for tenants who are women, you know, because it is still predominantly very white. So we cannot, you know, I mean, not wish in general, but the sector, obviously, you know, when you get to the senior levels, are still very white. And yeah, so we definitely have that as one of our sort of key objectives. How do we make sure we've got diversity in what we're doing here around supporting and advocating for women?
Yeah, thank you, Lara, for sharing your thoughts on that. I suppose just to pick up on that train of thought and some of the things you said, I just would like to invite you to talk a bit more about what you do with Black on Board. So what's it all about? And in particular, what changes would you like to see as a result of the work you're doing? Just to pick up on what Crystal said there, I think we talk a lot about what allyship from men looks like in supporting women, but what does allyship from women in leadership roles look like for other women, particularly, as you've said, for Black women who aren't represented in those spaces yet?
Excellent question. Lots to say to answer that question. So Black on Board is my response to Black Lives Matter. So I've been involved in training and coaching people to get into the boardroom since 2017, but as an associate of different organisations and, you know, helping people run their own courses. And then during 2020, when all the Black Lives Matter demonstrations were going on, I remember asking myself, how can I contribute strategically to this issue? Because it's an issue that obviously I've lived through it. I've seen my Black brothers and nephews and uncles and, you know, the Black men in my life have all been stopped by the police, threat. You know, we've all Black people go through all those experiences. And I said, well, I want to do something strategic and long term. I am not going to go on a demonstration because I've got a bad knee and I don't want to get COVID. Okay? So I thought, what can I do? And I thought long and hard, and I thought, you know what? The thing that I'm passionate about, where I feel I can make a difference, is to get more people into boardrooms. I can train them, I can coach them, I can make a difference. That's a long-term strategy. It's not going to be over in a year, because I knew that the whole hype of that summer was short. It was going to be short-lived. And it's about, I asked myself, how can we make the message, the point that we're trying to get out there, live beyond that summer? because I knew that the tide was going to turn, and which it has, like, drastically, yeah. Where no one's talking about it. It was a fashion, it was a fad. Whereas the issues that were raised at the time were relevant and still are relevant. Those issues are still happening. Black people still have to deal with all these issues. Every time I see a police officer, I assume I've done something wrong. It's just the way we're brought up, you know, and I worry for my young black boys, you know, relatives or not. But anyway, so I decided I was going to use my skills and set up my own training company and work with individuals, because the companies that I work with as an associate, they tend to work with employers. So they're commissioned by employers. And I said, well, I'm going to make myself available to individuals, individual black women, white women, anyone that's not a white man, because white men don't need me. There's enough of them in boardrooms. They do not need my help. So that's why I set up Black on Board, and I set that up, I think it was July 2020. I did not start trading until, I think it was late 2021 or 2022. So what I did in the whole of 2020 and most of 2021 was attend every single training course that I could find about getting people into boardrooms. That was my market research. I went to see what all my competitors were doing. Now, there's a lot of people in that space, you may or may not know this, but none of them is a black woman. There's lots of white men in that space, lots of white women in that space, lots of the big recruitment agency, but none of them can bring the perspective that I bring, which is often being the only black person in the boardroom, often being one of two or three women in a boardroom of 7, 8, 9, 10, or 11. And I can bring the experiences of having to navigate those spaces, having to fill yourself with the confidence to ask the question that you think, if I ask this question, will they just think I'm, here she goes again, she's always going on about race, kind of thing. So I thought, I bring that unique perspective into this space, and there are plenty of black professionals out there who I think should be in boardrooms. So yeah, that's why I set up Black on Board at the time. And I've never been out of business. There's lots of people who want to go into boardrooms. I love what I do. The other thing that I've started to do, that people approach me, which I'd never thought about it as a service offering, but I do a lot of now, is I sit on people's interview panels. Because a lot of people will say, we don't have anyone from a diverse background to sit on our panel for a CEO or head of housing, or we're recruiting lots of board members. Do you want to join us and sit on our panels and be the objective viewer from outside and bring your experience into it? And I love it, because I love people. I love talking to people. I love interviewing people. So that's a great thing that I do as well. I love it to bits. And the mission of Black on Board is very simple. It's just to get more people that look like me into boardrooms. Boardrooms should not be, 90% full of white men, even 85% full of white men, because white men only make up 30. I checked the stats the other day. 39% of UK population is white men.
Okay, yeah.
Therefore, there should only be 39% of white men in boardrooms.
Yes.
Because I often get asked, oh, but the best people for the job, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm thinking, sure, are you serious? And the other thing I will point out to you, that if you were to look at the profiles of the few black women in boardrooms and compare it to their white male counterparts, the black women are always overachievers, higher achievers. You have to do so much more just to get to that same level. Yeah. So that's why I set up Black on Board, and I have a lot of work to do. There's a lot of growth. It's a growth sector. It's just that there's not a lot of people doing it.
Yes. I suppose one day you hope that you won't need to do that work, because
I hope so. It's the same as my answer when people say, why do I volunteer to be chair of a homelessness charity? And I say, yeah, I hope one day that it will never be needed, but
yeah,
homelessness is still an issue. So the two passions that I have are again, about social change. They're not about making money at all. It's about trying to make the world a better place. And also about bringing people along, opening the doors for other people so that they can do well in their lives. Because like I said, I have no pets, no children, and I don't have a car. So I often ask myself, what is my purpose in life? Why am I here?
Yeah.
So I've decided it's here to help other people do well.
I do have children, pets and a car, Lara, and I still ask myself that question sometimes more so. What is the point in all of this? I think, you know, you've talked a lot about, I suppose, the work that you're doing to get more diversity into boardrooms and, some of the specific examples of that, Lara. And I know you're in a shoes campaign really focused on this and trying to sort of get organisations to really think about how do we enable more diversity in the boardroom. What do you think it is going to take to get that change?
I have an answer. I think it's going to take legislation.
Okay.
Yeah, no amount of kicking and shouting from me is making that much difference. Now, you may have noticed that every Thursday I highlight a board of a housing association.
So brave.
I know. Some people hate it. I often get lots of nasty comments. Some people are fine. Some organisations see it as a great opportunity to tell the world what they're doing, and I wish everybody would do that. So, like, I think one of the best responses came from Notting Hill Genesis. They've not paid me to plug them, but their response was just brilliant. Yeah. They're like, well, we're doing this. We know we're not perfect. Yeah. We're doing this, we're doing that, and we try this, and we'll do, you know, I thought it was a brilliant response. A couple of people have tried to sue me. Well, have threatened to sue me. Don't know what for, exposing the truth. I don't know. But anyway.
No, that's so, interesting.
What was the question?
What's it going to take to change it then, Lara?
I think legislation is the way forward, and I'll tell you why. You may or may not know, but for FTSE 100 companies, they are legally obliged to report on their diversity. This came into effect, I think it was January 2023, and they have a minimum target, which is 40% women. I don't know why it's not 50, but it's 40, and at least one person that is not white. Again, why it's just one person,
so
I don't know.
So just one person?
Just one person that is not white, and 40-60 male-female ratio. Now, why it's 40 and not 50% for the gender ratio, I don't know. And why they just think one person can satisfy all the other racial groups is ridiculous.
It's a very low bar.
But that is a legal requirement of FTSE 100 companies. And guess what? They've all met it. Mm-hmm. They have all met it. Usually they have one black woman. So she ticks the two boxes.
Yeah.
Now, I was looking at the board of Nationwide Building Society a while ago, and they had this, it must have changed now, but they had this one black woman there, and you looked at her CV, you're thinking, OMG, she was like phenomenal. The things that she had achieved, you're like, wow. And then you compare her CV with the numerous white Andrews and Johns and Davids, and they just seemed a bit, you know, a bit normal, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
A bit, you know, it's like your average random accountant of a large company, nothing outstanding. And that's the challenge that we face. So that's even within where there's a legislative requirement. So the point is, they've all met it because it's required of them. Therefore, it's done. Now, people have been talking about the lack of boardroom diversity before even I started. Mm-hmm. And so far, very little has changed. There are, I could probably name maybe 10 or 15 housing associations that I think have got relatively or very diverse boardrooms. One of them is Metropolitan Thames Valley. Mm-hmm. Another one that I quote a lot is, I can't remember that. I think it's Mosque St. Vincent's in Manchester. Diverse boardrooms, both diverse in terms of ethnicity and age as well, and gender, because a lot of boardrooms are full of old people like me. You know, I remember joining a board a while back and being told I was a bright young thing, and I was in my 50s. Do you know what I mean? It's, you know, and I'm like the young kid on the block. So I think boards are not diverse in terms of just ethnicity, but also age. We need more young people in the boardroom. So I'm saying that the FTSE 100 have done this because that's what they're being legislated to do. Mm-hmm. And I will be pushing this year or next year to have the same legislation that goes across the rest of society, not just housing associations, the NHS, the charity sector, if you look at teaching, all those professions where, for some reason, white men rise to the top. Whenever you see a woman or a black woman, we all get really excited. It's like, oh, wow, look, she's brilliant. She's got this job. It shouldn't be like that. It should just be normal.
Yeah.
We do get excited because it's so unusual. It's so rare. And the people that make it through are like 10 times more qualified than their male counterpart. Now, a good friend of mine, who's a white Scottish guy, he knows who he is, hopefully he'll be listening, said to me once, he said, Lara, we'll know that we have equality when there are as many mediocre black leaders as they are mediocre white.
I love it. That's fantastic.
So, so I think what we'll take is legislation, because the social housing regulator's not interested in this topic one bit.
No
interest whatsoever. And we know in social housing, we've got a very long to-do list. And if it's not on that list, it's not getting done. And the only things on that list are things that we have to do. Otherwise, we'll get penalised, downgraded, or we'll lose money. Okay? And none of those things apply to diversity in the boardroom. So I think legislation is the way forward.
That's really interesting, the sort of disparity between that narrative of customer first, like what a tenant voice, tenant satisfaction measures, and yet we're not talking about what boards look like. Because as you said, if 39% of the population are white males, then we know for a fact that the people living in our houses are majority not white males. So why is that not important at the board level for regulation?
It's interesting, isn't it? I asked the regulator at a conference back in 2017, I think it was, around this exact question, you know, what's the regulator's take on equality, diversity and inclusion, and does it need to be in the governance standard? I think, you know, that they have made steps with the tenant satisfaction measures, you know, being quite explicit that landlords have to make sure that the data they're collecting is at least a sample base of their actual residents. From what I can see, the regulators are not reporting that back to the sector, so they might be collecting it. Yeah. I don't think they're collecting it in that way. From what I've heard, organisations aren't saying, well, you know, of our black residents, we've got a 62% satisfaction rate, and of our white male ones, we've got a 90%. You know, we're not getting that data. But that was back in 2017, Lara, that the response was, it's not in the governance.
It's not changed, because I spoke to a representative of the regulator who I won't name during my presidency, which was 2023. So that's about 5 years after your conversation. And I was told that it's down to organisations to interpret the TSMs, which way they see fit. But they are not going to be banging the drum on this at all. It's for individual organisations to work out how they monitor what happens in the boardroom. Yeah. And since this conversation has been, as far as I know, going on for about the last 30, 40 years, it looks like just leaving it to people to do themselves is clearly not working. There are a few organisations who are trying to push this forward. I think HDN, Housing Diversity Network, are doing good work, but they're only making so much progress. And the progress has to be supported by individuals that are allies or interested in this argument. And like I said, if your to-do list has got finance and fire safety and I don't know, whatever else is it, your regulatory grading on it, they're going to be at the top of your to-do list. So that's what you're going to be focusing on as a housing association. You've got your damp and mould, et cetera, et cetera. But nowhere does it say boardroom diversity. And I think one of the tricks the sector missed was the Better Social Housing Review. What year was that one again? 2023? I can't remember now. The Better Social Housing Review was a great opportunity to make that difference in the sector, to say let's not pretend that race did not play a role in the situation that resulted in the Better Social Housing Review. Because the Better Social Housing Review came out of our Kishab. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah, but if you read the 8 recommendations at the back of that report, which is the sheet that most CEOs have got pinned on their notice board, doesn't mention race at all.
No.
It talks about knowing your buildings, like do asset survey, talks about going back to the old housing management patches, everything but race. Doesn't mention it at all.
Yeah, and the same with the Grenfell report, that you know, the conversation around race and ethnic minorities and high-rise buildings was noticeably absent from that conversation. Yeah.
It's almost like people are afraid to, I feel people like either afraid or embarrassed to mention it. I don't know why, or is it too controversial?
I think the sector is behind in a number of areas. One of them is this one. So I work in homelessness, I work for Crisis, a homelessness charity, and you know, there's reports all over the place in homelessness about racism in homelessness. And maybe it's because the sector is quite keen to make sure that the strategies, services that we develop are the ones that are going to end homelessness, because money's tight and that's what we exist for. We exist to end homelessness.
Yeah.
So if racism is, you know, a significant factor in that, we need to understand that to be able to end it.
Yeah.
So I suppose it comes back to mission, doesn't it?
It does. It does. Yeah.
So if you're a housing organisation, your mission is to serve your tenants.
Yeah.
And if that's the lens through which you see your purpose, then racism has to be on your agenda. Mm. Are we a racist organisation? I would want to know that as a housing association chief exec and board. So maybe it comes down to that purpose. Are you there to just do repairs and, you know, tick a box on whether you're meeting a standard, or are you there actually for your tenants? Yeah. I think in the time that we've got left, it would just be really lovely, Lara, to talk a little bit more about you personally. So one of the questions that we often ask is around, like, gosh, you've done so much. without, you know, the kids in the car and all of that, but
and insomnia as well.
Oh, crikey, bless you. but you know, we can't go down every path, can we? We can't push every door and take every opportunity that comes our way. And we like to have a conversation about that on the podcast, because regret is quite a big thing for women sometimes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So yeah, just keen to know, like, is there anything
that interesting you talk about regrets? I think about that often, and I genuinely say I don't have many regrets. It's interesting that I've always been nosy. Some people call it what's a nice word for nosy?
Curious.
I've always been curious. You know, I was like, oh, what's going on in there over there? Why is that here? I've always been the person that asks why when no one else dare ask why. Mm-hmm. And I found that's been very helpful in my career, because I've learned things that I was like, oh, that's how that works, and that's why that is there. So I find that I've got all these random bits of random information in my head just from asking why, that you never know when they're going to come in useful. I think I was sort of born with a slightly stubborn personality, which was, if you say to me I can't do something, and I'm probably going to go, well, actually I can, and then I'm going to show you that I can. Except in the areas where I know I'm totally useless, like, I don't know, I can't sing and I'm terrible with numbers. But I was like, yeah, well, actually, just you think I can't, but I will. So that's, I was lucky to born with that nature, as well as a nature that asked why. So I must have been a really irritating child just to think of that. It's just like, why? Yeah, if you say I can't do it, well, I'll show you how that I can do it. So the only things that I regret, and I don't like to use the word regret because it's outside of my control, the only things that I regret are things that other people have done to me.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't regret any choices that I've made. I've been in situations where I've had to decide what to do in a difficult situation, and I made a choice based on what I knew at the time, and I've had to live with the consequences. But I often look back and go, well, if that happened again, what would I do different? And often it's like, actually, I might not have done anything different, but I'd be more aware of the consequences, so I can plan for the consequences, if that makes sense. So I think there's a weird braveness that I have that I that I've lived with the consequences of, but I don't regret the decisions I made.
Yes.
I regret the circumstances that I found myself in before the decisions and sometimes after. But no, so I have very few regrets. I've had an interesting career. I've had lots of ups and downs. And every time I've had a down, I've come back up again. And each time I've learned from it, I think I'm a much stronger person. I'm much braver now than I was earlier, I think because of my experience. And I guess I've got the advantage of not being employed by anyone, so I can do and say what I like. Because you know, if I was employed by any social housing organisation, you name it, I would not be able to do those posts that I do every Thursday. I would have been sacked ages ago for bringing the organisation into disrepute or something along those lines.
Oh, I don't know, Lara. I think we might have you at Wish.
So what was the question again?
No, that's it. I think you've answered the question.
Yeah, regrets. I have very few regrets. If I can think of anything, it's not professional. I wish I'd been able to travel even more than I've traveled a lot, but there's still so many places that I've not been to yet. So I want to do more traveling. But I would say I have regrets.
Brilliant. Yeah. Thank you. So I think, Hannah, if you could ask our final question, important question.
Yes.
That would be great.
Yes, I have the privilege of asking the final and possibly most important question.
I'm going to say yes to the dress.
In the spirit of the podcast name, this should come as no surprise. But Lara, if you had one wish for the sector, what would it be and why?
I'm very frustrated that I have to stick with one.
There's no genie lamp with three one wishes wish. This time.
Okay. So in the fashion of what I've said during most of this conversation, I'm going to stick to women in boardrooms. If I had one wish, it would be that boardrooms were more representative of the gender dynamics in social housing, in the sector, in our communities, and on also the ethnicity dynamics as well. Boardrooms are far too white male. There are still some housing association boardrooms today that are predominantly white men and maybe one or two white women. It is shocking. They exist. Yeah. So that would be my wish, that the leadership of organisation was a lot more representative.
Well, we are your ally in that wish, Lara, and we will support and work really hard to deliver that on that. And, you know, I hope a few of those white men listen to the podcast when they're walking the dog.
I hope they listen too.
Whatever it is they do.
There is room for all of us. So it's not, I'm not anti-white men. I'm just saying we need to share. They need to share the cake a bit more. There's room for all of us.
Yes. Well, thank you so much. Gosh, we could go on for hours, I'm sure, and put the world right. But it has been amazing to have you on today's podcast, Lara. It's been just a wonderful discussion, really inspiring, and I hope our listeners feel that inspiration as they listen. Thank you, Hannah, for being my co-host. I hope you've enjoyed it.
Thank you.
It's brilliant to have lots of different voices on this podcast, and we're keen to use it as a platform to promote the women that are working in our sector. So thank you so much. And
thank you, Crystal, and thank you, Hannah.
Thank you, Lara. It's been fab to chat.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to the If I Had One Wish podcast. Next time, we'll be talking to another inspirational female from the housing sector who will be sharing her career story on what she's learned along the way. And of course, we'll be asking again the big question. If she had one wish, what would it be and why? See you next time.